to lose the two people in my life that I was closest to in really unexpected and sudden ways did a real number on my brain. Time heals everything is a lie. It heals nothing. If you just sit and wait to feel better, it doesn't work.
The whole thing is about acknowledging and redirecting. But really, for many people, the hardest part is not beating down on yourself for ruminating. And I think that's the trick to a lot of what you teach here.
The labels that we place on ourselves matter a lot. Labeling an emotion is helpful. But sometimes we place labels on ourselves like, I'm a really anxious person. It's that label that keeps us stuck in a lot of ways. People aren't born mentally strong. It's all about the choices that we make every single day. It's not about feeling strong 100% of the time either. It's just about knowing, what am I going to do when I don't feel strong?
Well, everybody, welcome back to Success Rewritten. I'm your host, Emily Lomenzo-Washkovic, and today's interview is with Amy Morin. I'm so grateful to have been introduced to her through a friend. If you haven't heard Amy's name before, she's a psychotherapist, she is a best-selling author of multiple books, and she currently lives on a boat in the Florida Keys, which I'm really excited to talk more about and learn more about. Amy, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
It's going to be awesome. Before we dive into some of your recent work and the things that you're doing today to help people get mentally strong, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of your journey to becoming an author?
Sure. So I am a therapist and started my career in rural Maine, working with adults and kids mostly at the time. And about a year into my work, my mom passed away suddenly from a brain aneurysm. And while I was grieving that loss, it was a stark realization that a lot of the skills and tools and things that I had learned in college actually fell pretty short when you're going through a painful experience. They looked good on paper, but in real life, I thought, oh, here are these things that I thought were really helpful, but I didn't find them as helpful as I thought they should have been. And that's what launched my personal interest then in mental strength and knowing like, all right, what really works when you're going through a tough time? And I'm glad that I started working on that because 3 years to the day that my mom died, my 26-year-old husband died of a heart attack. And to lose the two people in my life that I was closest to in really unexpected and sudden ways did a real number on my brain. I was thankful I was a therapist and I at least knew about things like PTSD, but knowing about them and then figuring out how do you work through it was a completely different beast. And I had still had to go to work as a therapist, right? So after my husband passed away, I didn't want to be homeless and we had a mortgage. But of course, when we bought the house, I thought we had two incomes. So now I'm down to one and I had to figure out how am I going to pay the bills. So I had to go to work as a therapist and figure out how am I going to at least look semi-professional, make sure I'm in a headspace where I can kind of help people. But at the same time, my own life was in shambles. And it took years, really, to figure out which way was up, which way was down, and to start thinking about this next chapter of my life. I was 26, so at the time, like a lot of my friends were just starting to get married, they're talking about kids, they're launching their careers, and I'm a widow. Like the only people I knew who were widowed were like 80. And so to figure out like, who am I? Where do I fit into the world? And what am I going to do next? We were foster parents, so I was like, do I still want to be a single foster mom? Or don't I? What do I want to do? Like, what am I going to do with my spare time? So many things. And it took years to really work my way through and to get a sense of, okay, this next chapter of my life. But I was fortunate. I found love again. I got remarried. We got a new house, got a new job. Like things are looking pretty good for a minute. And then my father-in-law was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And I just remember thinking like, okay, I lost two people and I didn't expect it. And this time I know what's coming and I don't want to go through it, but it wasn't like I had a choice, right? I had just spent years grieving and doubted if I could handle one more loss. And it was on one of my worst days that I wrote myself a letter of what mentally strong people don't do. Like the last thing I needed was a list of what to do. So I wrote myself a letter of what not to do. And I would read it every day. Like, okay, Amy, just don't do these things. Number one on the list was don't feel sorry for yourself. So like, okay, as long as I don't feel sorry for myself, I'll get through the day. And I found the letter helpful. So I thought, maybe it'll help somebody else. I put it on the internet. I got paid $15 for it. I thought like five people would read it, but 50 million people read the list. One of them was a literary agent who said, hey, you should write a book. And I said, oh, you know, thank you, but I'm a therapist. I don't know how to write a book. I'm not an author. Luckily, she followed up with me again and was like, no, really, I think you should write a book. But the problem was the article on the internet just basically said, here are 13 things to avoid. It didn't say, oh, by the way, I struggle with these things. And so everybody who was reading this article assumed she's mastered this list. So within a few days of publishing it, like CNN in Mexico, MTV in Finland, like media outlets from across the globe are calling me and they're like, let's talk to this expert on mental strength. And I felt horrible at the time because I thought, I didn't write this from the top of the mountain. Like I'm at the bottom of the valley and I struggle with all of these things. So then I had to decide, if I'm going to write a book, am I going to tell the truth? It's not that I'm the expert in all of this stuff. It's that I'm struggling with all of it. But decided to go ahead and tell the rest of the story that I, in fact, struggle with all 13 things. And the book came out the following year. And that was in 2014 that the book was launched. And here we are, still speaking about mental strength. And I've written 7 books in the meantime.
It is so amazing, first of all, that you have the ability to tell your story in that very abridged way to start, because I think for so many people to even fathom one of those losses is so much. And I do think it speaks to the journey that you've had. It's now been 12 years since that first book came out. Before we even dig into like the mental strength, and I feel like I have so much I want to talk to you about, because I went through inpatient and outpatient treatment rooted in CBT, and like so much of what you teach is CBT like tie backs. And so I'm excited to help everyone with that. But before we even get into that, I feel like we have to talk about why you were basically forced to come up with this list for yourself, which is the cultural experience around grief, especially in this country. It's kind of like, okay, you had a loss and then get back to it and, you know, you'll figure it out. And even, you know, bereavement leave in America being on average 3 days, these are all things that until it hits you or you're impacted by a significant loss, I don't think it's as easy to understand. Can you just share from your own experience and as a therapist, what that period is like? And I want to just kind of normalize for people how insane it is that we're asking them to get back to mental toughness and be at work. Like all of this stuff is amazing. But even before that, I feel like we need to address this cultural problem that we have.
I think you're absolutely right, because it's so weird that unfortunately, all of us are going to experience grief at one time or another. Yet nobody talks about it. And when you're going through it, people don't know what to say or do. And I agree. When I have a friend who loses somebody, I'm like, oh, sorry for your loss. I mean, it feels like it falls really short, but sometimes there just are no words. And we're uncomfortable with people when they're sad, right? And so if your friend, somebody in your life is really sad, like our natural inclination is to cheer them up. Like, let's go bubbling and get you out of the house. And it's okay to be sad. In fact, grief is the process by which we heal. You have to go through it, but our tendency is to go around. And like, you'll hear people say stuff like, I'm just staying busy. And somebody will say, oh, that's so good, right? Like, that's great that you're staying really busy while you're going through this really tough time in your life. And for some people, like that can be a great short-term distraction. But if you just busy yourself to try to like white knuckle it while your heart is broken, you don't actually heal. And that's what I was seeing in my office, was people saying, gosh, Amy, I have waited 10 years since I had this loss and I still don't feel better. And I'd have to explain to them that idea that time heals everything is a lie. It heals nothing. If you just sit and wait to feel better, like it doesn't work. Or if you just distract yourself or you avoid all of those uncomfortable emotions, you don't even start working through them yet. And so I do think that on a cultural level, it would be amazing if we could acknowledge grief, but so much weirdness. I mean, I was a therapist, so at least my coworkers like understood like what I was going through. So I was fortunate in that way, but I got 3 days of bereavement time when my husband died. Like we hadn't even had the funeral yet. And so I had applied for short-term disability and they said, we don't cover grief. And my sister, who happens to be a therapist, said, watch this. And she marched me into my doctor's office and she said, like, look at her. Do you think she can go to work? And I'm like, okay, go to work. And my doctor said, oh, I'll diagnose you with acute stress disorder, which is the precursor to PTSD, which as a therapist, I'll say fit in that moment. I saw some things. And that bought me like 2 months of bereavement time, which was really needed. And I get that I was really fortunate to have that. I mean, it, just to get my husband's name off of like the phone bill so I could call the phone company. I mean, it, practical things take a really long time. The paperwork, the running around and doing all of that stuff and the ridiculousness of, you know, the internet company calling and being like, well, we can't talk to you. We need to speak to your husband. And having to explain over and over again of why I was calling. And so I feel like I was fortunate to get that. But then to step back in as a therapist where I thought, ooh, you know, at that moment, I wished I had was able to do a job that didn't really deal with people because I thought, you know, if I were an accountant dealing with numbers, I could probably be crying at my desk on a bad day, but I can't do that as a therapist. And so what's that going to look like and how am I going to get through it? And my coworkers knew as well, like, okay, you coming back to work is going to be tough. So we held a meeting before I went back to work, which was a wonderful thing that they did for me to say, like, how can we support you? And what would that look like? And we had all agreed that nobody in the office, it was a fairly big office with lots of therapists and administrative staff and stuff, but they all came up with a plan that I got to approve. But essentially it was, we won't ask you how you're doing during the workday. Like if we run into you in the hallway and we say, oh, how are you? Or we bump into you in the break room and we're like, oh, I was thinking about you lately. Like, that's really not a kind thing to do when you're trying to focus on work. We don't need you to break out into tears in between your therapy clients. And so they would come to me at 5 o'clock at the end of the day. And sometimes they would just say, how are you? And we could have a conversation then. And I just so appreciated because sometimes it's about our need, right? We want to check in with somebody like, how are you doing? And then we feel better. Like I just checked in. And Jimmy says he's doing all right. So now I can move on with my day. Or you run into somebody in the grocery store and you're like in aisle 7 and you're like, oh, I haven't seen you. You know, how have you been? I heard. And the person starts crying in the middle of the grocery store. And well, it's often appreciated to know that people are thinking about you and people haven't forgotten you, even though the funeral is over. I think it's important to be mindful of when and how we did it, especially in the workplace. Workplace can be so awkward, right? Like people are like, I've seen my coworkers sitting at a desk and now I like know all this personal stuff about you. And that was another thing that my boss did. She called me and she said, some of us would like to go to the funeral, but we realize that might be weird for you. I hadn't worked there very long, so I didn't really know my coworkers very well outside of the office. I had never seen them in any other setting. So they're like, that's going to be weird. Like, we're going to meet your dad. Is that too weird for you? And I said, you know, I would welcome that. Thank you. And so they did. A whole bunch of them came to the funeral and I really appreciated that. But I think, you know, the fact that they knew to ask first was really cool because otherwise, I don't know, if nobody had shown up, I might've thought they didn't care. Or if everybody had shown up and surprised me, I might've thought, well, this is strange. My coworkers are watching me cry. So I think sometimes when you don't know what to do, it's okay to ask. And to be
the best to ask,
right? To just be mindful of like, is this serving my need? Cause I'll feel better when you say you're okay. Or is this really helpful for me to ask you during your lunch break how you're doing?
Yeah. Well, and something that I think you mentioned that's so important is you can make suggestions, but run them by the person because sometimes saying, let me know what we can do for you or let us know if you need anything. That like puts so much onus on the person going through the grief or whatever it is to now come up with something for you to help them with. And so I love that your coworkers thought of things and then ran them by you because everyone is different, you know, and you want to make sure that the way you're supporting is actually going to benefit the person you're trying to support. I'm also really glad you mentioned the funeral thing because something I've learned in my older years, you know, just having more losses different degrees away, is sometimes you go to the funeral to support the person who experienced the loss. So like, you know, going to the funeral of your friend's dad, even if you've never met their dad, that might be really welcomed by them and made them feel loved and supported. But I do think it's good to ask if you're unsure, you know, like, because I've even had friends where I've asked and they've said, oh, it's just going to be immediate family, but thank you so much for asking. And so I think that's really mindful and it is hard because we don't know how people are feeling and we don't want to do it wrong. But honestly, asking and making that connection is better than nothing, I think, you know, even if it's an attempt that isn't in their, you know, ideal way. You learn from that. Maybe you gather information, but asking is so valuable and giving them a chance to say yes, no, or what would be better.
Yeah. And sometimes we make assumptions, right? Like, well, your grandmother was 95, so therefore maybe you shouldn't grieve so much, or, you know, and I think it's important to check our assumptions of like how, when we want to judge how somebody's grieving or how sad they are, or when somebody's struggling after a loss, is to know just because maybe you think you wouldn't struggle that much, like it's not you, it's not your circumstances, it's not for you to judge. Because I think we also have this idea, though, that like the amount of pain that you publicly show somehow equates to how much love you had for the person. And I don't think that's an accurate measuring stick either, because I can remember people saying stuff to me too, like, you're so strong, like you're not even crying. And number one, I was like, well, the absence of tears is not a sign of strength. But number two, like, you know, you don't know what I was doing an hour ago, but just because I'm buying groceries at the moment doesn't mean I'm callous. But I think, you know, just to be mindful of the assumptions that we make and to know that we don't know what people are going through inside their own minds. And as a therapist, I had the luxury of knowing that. I would see people that walk into my therapy office who look like they have it all together. And they were definitely fighting some private battles that even their best friends and family didn't know.
Yeah. And something that I think is really valuable for your journey and why your work is so like accessible is the fact that you did have a clinical understanding, but then the lived experience to really connect those dots. Because I even think about my own journey. Like, I didn't grow up experiencing mental health challenges or struggles. It wasn't like something that we talked about a lot. And when I first met my now husband and we were dating, he was going through some generalized anxiety, but like trying to figure that out. He didn't really know what it was either. And as he was learning that, I was kind of like trying to understand and learn and read about it and ask him, but I had never felt it. And then, you know, not long after I had a manic episode, I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I started experiencing my own types of internal feelings, thoughts, all of that. And it definitely gave me like an extra like prism on understanding and being able to explain to other people, whether it was like, this is how it feels for me, or I read this story of someone and it shows they described it this way. And so I just feel like you were going through this experience of having understanding and then also getting like a front row seat to how it felt inside you. Can you maybe share for people what that's like? Because I do think if you haven't experienced it before and you're trying to support a friend or a family member, there is like a disconnect between just an understanding of what is maybe happening and feeling it yourself.
Absolutely. And again, sometimes we just think, oh, grief is like you're sad or you kind of miss the person, but it's all encompassing. Like, it's not like you just miss the person. It's like you don't even know how to be in the world. It's like the entire world has flipped upside down and you're trying to go through it without the most important person in your entire life. And nothing makes sense. It's almost like if somebody suddenly rearranged all the furniture and said, close your eyes and make it through the house. And you're like stumbling and running into stuff. Like, that's what life feels like when you're going through grief. Like, I struggled to like know how to get ready in the morning. My husband and I used to get ready together. So to get ready for work, I was like, my first day back, I'm like, how does this work? Right? Like, I guess I make my own coffee. And it's physical too. Like, so many people have physical symptoms. And, you know, your stomach is upset, your head hurts, your blood pressure is high. I broke out in acne. I'm 26. And I remember my dermatologist was like, you should really manage your stress better. He had no idea what I was going through, of course, but awesome. Thank you. Thank you for that input. And you know, the solutions to working through the pain are often like, get some exercise, make sure you sleep, eat a healthy diet. When you are in immense emotional pain, like, all of those things feel almost impossible. Where you're like, well, I'd sleep if I could. I'd eat if I had an appetite. Well, I'd go for a walk if I had some energy. And you have to really force yourself just to go for a walk around the block. And I was in Maine, it was February, and I could go outside with a t-shirt on and I didn't feel the cold. And it would, of course, horrify people. It's like 12 degrees outside. It's windy and everybody else is bundled up and frozen. And they'd be like, oh my gosh, like put a coat on. And I'm like, oh, really? Like, no idea. And so proof that like it was definitely a biological component to it as well. Like I'm naturally going to be cold under 80 degrees. So the fact that I could stand outside in the cold and not feel it was just a reminder of like, it affects every part of your being. And then I was reminded too, like as a therapist, how when people are like, I'm going to try to join a grief group, like how difficult that is to try to join a grief group, how difficult it is to take that first step, that balance between saying like, I would like to be around people who understand how it feels, but at the same time, like, I don't want to sit in a circle and have everybody just crying. Like that doesn't sound like a good Friday night either. So just knowing that like a lot of the things people say fall short, a lot of people don't know what to say. And on the inside, it just feels like, I don't know, I felt like nothing felt like home anymore. I felt like nothing that used to be comfortable was comfortable. Everything I just flipped upside down. The things I used to like to do on a Friday night were different. Even a Friday, like, you know, it used to be you work Monday through Friday. What do you look forward to? Ooh, Friday evening. Suddenly on Monday, I'm like, oh, I got no plans next weekend. My house is empty. Not so looking forward to Friday. However, I also don't feel like being at work. And that feeling of like, I don't want to be there. I don't want to be here. I don't even know where to be. And people who would reach out to me, they were so kind. And I was fortunate that friends and family would reach out to me, but it was like there was just a void, an emptiness that lasted a very long time.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate that when you did start sharing and people said, hey, you're an expert, you wanted to move forward, because I think that might have been a point for some people where they're like, oh, this was just like a little letter to myself or a little blog. And it really has helped so many people. I mean, that first book has been out for over a decade. I had heard of it many years ago before I read it the first time. But when we were connected and I knew I was going to have you on, that was when I realized all the iterations of the book that you've created. So let's fast forward a little bit to now, this moment where, like you said, you're not at the top of the mountain, but you've been able to articulate a list that's helping you put your foot in front of the other every day. How did you then, with the response from other people, really feel like, okay, now we're going to systemize this and customize it for different human experiences?
So it turned out to be quite easy. Since I didn't plan to be an author, I just thought, oh, all right, I'm going to write this book now. Completely ignorant of how publishing worked, how books worked, anything, but kept my day job as a therapist. So wrote the book nights and weekends, got it done, and I thought, that's good. I got to be a therapist who wrote a book. How nice. And didn't really even know how to market it or anything like that. And then about a year and a half, it sold okay, but obviously 50 million people read the article and it fell flat compared to what my publisher had hoped. Like, oh, 50 million people will buy the book and buy it for a friend. But it did not do that. So it was like, it sold okay. But I remember having a conversation with my agent that was like, you know, you might get another book deal, probably not with this publisher, but maybe. But an amazing thing happened. It became a book that sold by word of mouth, that when people would read it, they would say, oh, you know, who needs this book? It's my friend, or I'm going to recommend it, or I'm going to tell people it helped me. And so most books, if they hit a bestseller list, it's the first week that it goes on sale because you have all the pre-orders and everything and all of the press. My book hit the bestseller list about a year and a half after it came out. It hit Wall Street Journal and USA Today. So I had this moment of, maybe I could write another book. Like, should I? And the number one question people were asking me was, how do we teach kids to be mentally strong? And so many people said, my life could have been different if I had only learned this stuff when I was 12 as compared to when I'm like 55. And I can't help but feel kind of angry that I didn't learn this sooner, but I want to make sure that my kids or my grandkids or that the young generation learns this stuff. How do we do that? And because I kept getting that same question over and over, I decided I'll write a parenting book. So I reached out to my publisher and said, what do you think? And they were like 100% on board. Let's do this. So 13 Things Mentally Strong Parents Don't Do came out, I think, in 2017.
And you were not a parent at that time.
I was a foster parent. And
Right. But I'm kind of like obsessed with the fact that, keep going.
Yeah, well, that was one of my questions to my publisher is like, you know, I don't have biological kids. Are people going to take me seriously? And they had said, well, you were a therapeutic foster parent. Like I took in the kids who we thought were kind of like at the end of the road, the kids that the state was trying to decide if they were adoptable. And some people don't know this, that when certain kids are deemed unadoptable, they go live in a group home, which is essentially a modern day orphanage. And then they turn 18 and they get kicked out onto the street and they don't have a family member to call or anybody to say, help, I need somewhere to go on Thanksgiving or anything like that, unless they go back to their biological families, which some do and some don't have that option. But because of behavior problems, the ones that I got were kind of on the fence. They had been placed with various relatives who didn't know how to manage a child who'd been through trauma, or they were placed in foster homes with parents who just didn't know what to do. The state knew I was a therapist, so I got the kids with the behavior problems. And I have to say, like, I love like the naughty kids who kick in the shins. I'm like, these kids haven't given up. There were so many kids in foster care who were like overly compliant and they were just do whatever you wanted them to do. And then I kind of like the kids that had some spunk to them that would be like, oh yeah. And happy to say that all the kids that came through my house were able to be placed up for adoption. And so I guess I knew that as a parent, I knew a bit about what it was to raise. I didn't have, like I say, a biological child, but I thought, all right, I had kids from 4 to 17 over the years. And as a therapist, I had worked with plenty of parents and worked with families and plenty of kids over the years. So my publisher's all, yeah, we think you can write this book. So I did. And absolutely like loved writing a parenting book. And then after that book came out, I got so many questions from women who said, well, when we talk about mental toughness, it's usually about a Navy SEAL or it's about an athlete. What does it look like to be a strong woman? And so I wrote 13 Things Mentally Strong Women Don't Do. And it's really about some of the societal pressures that women face, the cultural norms, things that are a little bit different. And then after that book came out, I decided, you know, it's time to write the kids' book, because so many parents are saying, this is great, but I want my 7-year-old to learn how to do this stuff. And while I can reinforce it, like, is there some language I can use with them? So I wrote a kids' book, which was super fun. 13 Things Strong Kids Do. It was the only book I'd written that was in a do instead of a don't do. And then I wrote a workbook, because lots of people were saying, okay, I have the principles, but I want to put them into practice. So I wrote the 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do workbook. And then after that, the couples book, because people were saying, how do we grow stronger together? Or my partner doesn't believe in a lot of this stuff I do. What do I do? And I'd done couples work. So I said, great, let's write a book about relationships, because it's true. Our relationships affect our mental strength. So then that was book number 6. And then it just felt like it was time to write a to-do book, because while all of these principles helped me know what to avoid, I was getting questions from people like, great, but at 2 p.m. on a Tuesday, when I'm really stressed out and I'm not feeling sorry for myself, but I have a meeting and maybe my personal life is a dumpster fire at the moment and I'm so stressed out and worried about my child or something else going on, but I had to be professional in this meeting. And there's so much advice out there from people that will be like, well, if you're going through a tough time, take time off. And like, that's not really reasonable for most of us. When you're going through a tough time, you don't get endless time off, or you don't get to take a mental health day every time you're stressed out. But yet nobody talks about, how do you go to work? How do you show up for that meeting when, you know, you just got a phone call that said your mother fell at the nursing home, or when you're dealing with the principal calling saying your child is misbehaving and you have to have a meeting tomorrow. So I wanted to write a book about that. What do you do at 2 p.m. on a Tuesday when you have a meeting coming up and you're crying at your desk and you have to walk in and at least look professional because you need the pay and you need the benefits? So that's what the Mental Strength Playbook is all about. Those little coping strategies, they're the ones that got me through it when I went back to work, and the ones that I still use today, and they've helped me get to be where I am now as well.
I think the next step is that you're going to become one of those TV therapists where we get to watch you talk to different people for a limited period of time. Please tell me that you've seen those. There's like the HBO one. Okay, good. So I think we should put you in whatever bucket we need to put you in. That's your next thing after the books, is letting us watch you do it with the people. Okay, let's talk about this book. Something that I really like about it, before we even like talk about some of your favorite parts, the way that you set up every chapter is very easy for someone to not only understand what the like hack is, but it works them through everything. I mean, in my opinion, everything, right? you frame every chapter with the objective. You give an example situation and then the play. I like how you call it the play. We'll talk about that in a second. Then you explain like why it works, when to use it, and how to do it. But every single chapter gives you like the things that you really want to focus on, the pitfalls that you might want to avoid. It really like walks through teaching you it and giving you the steps to put it into practice. And this book is so perfect where you could just go to a section that you need to revisit to remember. How did you come up with the format? Like, is that just what you found is a good way for people to digest the information? Because I feel like this is way different than a self-help book that gives you a couple tips.
Well, that's the thing. And I was finding like a lot of times people would come into my therapy office and they're like, you know, I've been practicing mindfulness for years and it's a little helpful, but it's not as helpful as I had hoped. And you take something like mindfulness, it's a wonderful tool, but it's only one tool and it doesn't work for every situation. And I wanted people to know that, like, there's so many different skills and strategies and they all don't work for just one situation. If you try practicing mindfulness right before you get on stage to deliver a keynote speech, it might not be the best strategy for you. You might be much better off to use something else. So I wanted people to know, like, you don't have to concentrate on one of these. Because I felt like so many people were like, you know, I read this book on X and I felt like it was helpful, but not, it didn't change my life. And then they would sometimes beat themselves up because they're like, oh, everybody else who meditates says it's perfect. And I just wanted people to know there's so many things and different situations call for different things. If you're nervous about giving a keynote speech at your job, like, no, absolutely, you might need one skill. But if you're nervous about making a sales call, you might need a different strategy. Or you're nervous about asking for a raise, that might call for something else. And so as a therapist, I work with people on all sorts of different skills, but there really wasn't a book that put them all in one place and said, let's flip open to the one that you need right now. So I thought, yeah, well, somebody needs to write the book. Why not? And I wanted it to be that more like a reference guide too. So if you're like, okay, I need some confidence here because I'm about to pitch an idea and I don't know if it's going to be well received. What do I do? And when our stress is high, we don't think clearly. It's hard to know what to do. And a lot of people assume if I don't feel strong, then I'm not strong. And my argument is, you just need to know a play that you can run. You pause, you pick, you run the play. And I wanted to give people that reference guide of, let's figure out what play you could run right now. And it's a strategy, just like if you were a coach in a game, you don't know what the other team's going to do. But when you run into a challenge, you think, let's try this one. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. If it doesn't, you have another play up your sleeve. And when I viewed my life like that, like, all right, it's not about having all the right answers. It's not about just white knuckling it through life. It's a strategy. I'm going to run a different play. That's what got me through it on my toughest days, but also helps me even now when life is good and I'm working on something kind of creative or I'm brainstorming something, like there's always a play I can run.
Absolutely. And I really like the fact that when you read this, you can understand yourself and how to, like, you know, change your mindset, strengthen your mindset. But I also think it helps you better understand other people. Even if you don't know everything that's happening under the surface, the way you describe some of those feelings of pressure or overwhelm or stress, I do think it gives us more context for how to interact with other people, which is super valuable. When it comes to like the CBT stuff, you would say that you practice CBT, right? That's like, okay, so for people that don't know, CBT is cognitive behavioral therapy. And I guess the reason that it kept popping up for me is because when I was in treatment, the biggest thing that I learned was that the easiest way to change your mentality is to first like acknowledge when it's not the way that you want it to be. And so for many people who might read this, you might read some of the stuff that Amy puts out there and says, you know, maybe you're having these feelings or thoughts. And if you haven't even really thought about the fact that you're ruminating on something, that is kind of like a weird eye-opening experience of being aware of what you think or feel or how you behave. And the key to making a change is acknowledging that you're feeling that way or doing that thing. And then changing the behavior, but not beating down on yourself for having that thought in the first place. And we used to use this thing called banned books. Maybe you've heard of them, but the general concept is like you carry around this little book and you have a banned behavior that you want to stop doing, or maybe something that you want to start doing. So the banned behavior is like the lack of. And you go throughout your day, and whenever you notice that you do something you don't want to be doing or think something you don't want to think, you pull out your little book and you notate that that happened. And the whole thing is about acknowledging and redirecting. But really, for many people, the hardest part is not beating down on yourself for ruminating. And I think that's the trick to a lot of what you teach here. It's like the acknowledgement, run the play, but you also have to like get off your own back a little bit as you move through this process of trying things out. Can you maybe expand on that?
Yeah, like the labels that we place on ourselves matter a lot. So look, labeling an emotion is helpful. There's a play in the book called Name It to Tame It. So if I say, gosh, I'm anxious, my anxiety decreases a little bit because I've just helped my brain and my body make sense of what's going on. So research will show that that's one of the best ways to reduce an intense emotion. But sometimes we place labels on ourselves like, I'm a really anxious person. And then guess what? Well, then I start thinking about what's going to happen tomorrow. But because I've already labeled myself an anxious person, I start just imagining catastrophic predictions, or somebody invites me to go do something that I've never done before. And I think, oh, I'm an anxious person. I can't do that. And it's that label that keeps us stuck in a lot of ways. And then, as you say, we don't notice it. It just becomes our identity of who I am. I'm not the kind of person who could do that. Or I'm the kind of person who is always an overthinker. I'm a perfectionist. And we get stuck in these loops that reinforce our behavior. They become a self-fulfilling prophecy. And sometimes people want to go back to childhood. Like, let's re-examine at age 7 why I started doing this. And that can be helpful sometimes. But I was finding too that sometimes people were coming into my office and just wanting to like dissect everything. Like, well, why did I say this to John on this phone call? Was it because when I was 7, my grandmother said, and to the point that then they couldn't take action. They just wanted to like rehash everything. And our thoughts play a big role in how we feel and what we do. But sometimes you need to take the action first. It's not about saying, well, when I feel confident, I'll go back to college. Maybe you need to go to college to feel confident. Or when I feel strong, then I'll volunteer to take on that new project. But maybe you need to take on the project first and then prove to yourself that you're strong, because your brain will underestimate you. It doubts you. It doesn't see what you're capable of. And the best way to do it is to train it, to basically show, actually, I can do more than you think I can. And when you have that mentality, and then when you recognize, all right, well, I messed up over here, not because I'm a bad person, but because I'm a human, and you have some more self-compassion, it's easier to change those behaviors, or to just sometimes accept, like, all right, look, I grew up an incredibly anxious kid. So to this day, I'll have anxious thoughts, and I can accept there's a part of me, of my brain, that always wants to go to the worst case scenario. And that's okay. I don't have to silence it, but I don't have to listen to it either. Instead, I can be my own boss and say, yeah, I'm going to do this thing anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk for a minute about your gratitude practice, because something that really like lit up for me was that 2-minute time frame that you recommend. And I think so many of us have heard, you have to practice gratitude. You have to practice gratitude. I feel like my brain is kind of wired that way. Like when I was laid off, I'm immediately thinking like, thank God I own a house with a really cheap mortgage. Like my brain kind of goes that way. I feel like my mom was always good, bad, or indifferent, like pushing towards looking at the positive. Sometimes you're like, can I just feel what I want to feel? But it is a little bit of a trained thing for some people. And if you feel like your brain can't come up with a gratitude list, I love your suggestion, Amy, of setting time around it, because then it kind of starts to flow. Can you walk everyone through what that play is for the gratitude hack?
Yeah, so it's the 2-minute gratitude flash. Because what I was finding is a lot of people are like, well, I practice gratitude, but unless I'd say, well, what does that mean? Like, well, I just say I'm grateful that I have clean water to drink and air to breathe. But it didn't really like drum up true feelings of gratitude. Or people are like, every day I just come up with the same things. You know, we sit around the dinner table and I say, I'm grateful that I had a job today, or I'm grateful that the sun was shining. So the 2-minute gratitude flash is something that you can do anywhere, anytime. But basically, you take out a piece of paper, you set a timer for 2 minutes, And you just start writing down, what am I grateful for right now? And the more that you start coming up with specific things, like, you know, I'm grateful that I had a clean shirt to wear this morning. I'm grateful that my coworker smiled and held the door for me. I'm grateful that my car ran fine on the way to work. Whatever it is, once you start thinking about things that you're grateful for, it activates the part of your brain that's also filled with other memories associated with gratitude. So then the more you think about those things, the more you start thinking about more things. And the 2-minute timer puts some pressure on you. If I just said, make a list of what you're grateful for, it can feel like this is a chore. It's going to last forever. Or we just come up with a few vague things and then we move on. There's something about the 2-minute timer that puts the pressure on you. And once people start writing, like their pencil just keeps moving. They just keep going and going. And it becomes easier and easier to think about the things you're grateful for. And by the end of the 2 minutes, most people say, you know, I feel a lot lighter, feel more positive about the future, more hopeful. And I think gratitude is such an underrated superpower. We know that grateful people live longer. They take better care of their health. They tend to have better quality sleep. Like, it's not just that they sleep longer, but they say, I slept a lot better. I feel more well-rested. And who doesn't want that these days? And grateful people are like 15% happier instantly. I mean, the list goes on and on about how powerful it is. And it, just in 2 minutes. And it's one of those things you can do at your desk at work when you're having a bad day. You do the 2-minute gratitude flash and it can turn your entire day around.
Well, and one of your clients does it at lunch every day, which I thought was awesome. My husband and I, the first year we were together, we were distant. So I lived in California and he lived here. And that was when this anxiety stuff was coming up for him. And we used to do best and worst thing of the day. So every day at the end of the day, we would say what the best and the worst thing was. And you would notice how sometimes over time, tracking the worst thing and how little it was sometimes, that was also like a superpower. You know, you're thinking of like, okay, wow, I kind of had to think pretty hard the past few days about what the worst thing was. So if you don't like just thinking about all the things you're grateful for, you can start to track some of the worst things and see how that trajectory goes. But you have to add a best thing too. You can't just track the worst thing of every day. I love that hack. Okay, one other thing I want to talk about before we like tell everyone where they can find the work and kind of give our final close out here. The section where you told people they need to get better language around emotions and grow their vocabulary around emotions, that to me felt so powerful for just the average human. I think we sometimes only think of a handful of emotions. And by expanding our vocabulary, it helps us better describe things and also removes the good or bad that we attach to emotions. Can you talk a little bit about how you've seen that in your work? I mean, I know where everyone can get a good list, page 110, but how have you kind of seen that in practice and how does this help people so effectively?
So, you know, a lot of people talk about emotional intelligence and how important it is, but I found even a lot of people who describe themselves as emotionally intelligent struggle to name feeling words. So I'm speaking at a conference and I have a whole bunch of really high powered executives in the room. And I say, I'll give you 2 minutes, write down as many feeling words as you can. They average about 5. And the look of horror on their face, once you get past like mad, sad, happy, scared, like we don't use a lot of feeling words in everyday language. When you're talking to somebody, like when's the last time you've said to somebody, like, I feel really sad today. And then we really don't get into the nuanced things, like when you're frustrated or you're disappointed. And so I'll encourage people to take a list of feeling words and you tape it on your bathroom mirror. And maybe you just, as you're brushing your teeth in the morning and before you go to bed, hopefully, you just read the list and you say, how do I feel right now? And you mentioned before about this idea of positive or negative. And I'll hear that so often, even from people in the psychology field, like, well, when you have a negative emotion. But emotions aren't negative. I think any emotion has the power to be really powerful. Like some people will say, anger is a negative emotion. But is it? Like, there's plenty of times that when I've been angry about something, it's given me courage to speak up in a case that I normally wouldn't speak up. Or it's given me energy to do something because I'm like, you know what? I'm really mad about this. So therefore, I'm going to do something. Or excitement. People would think, oh, excitement. Well, that's a positive emotion. But I can think of plenty of examples of really smart people that fell prey to a get-rich-quick scheme because they were excited about it. So it's not that emotions are good or bad, but understanding how do I feel today? And how might this emotion affect me? Like, research will show I might be anxious about something in my personal life. Maybe a loved one has an illness and I'm worried about them. I go to work and my boss says, hey, do you want to take on this new project? I'm much more likely to say no. Even though my anxiety has nothing to do with this work task, it spills over. But if I walked into work that day saying, you know, I feel pretty anxious today about something, and I could recognize that, then I would know, well, my impulse is going to be to say no to almost everything that comes my way because I'm anxious. But let me think about it. So when somebody asks me, hey, do you want to take on this new opportunity? I can pause and think, do I? Does it make sense? And I can be more logical about it. And understanding our emotions is key to then recognizing what kind of influence do they have on the decisions that I'm making. We make our best decisions when our emotions and our logic are in check, but the more emotional we get, the less logical we are. So fortunately, we can raise our logic to balance out those emotions. So when somebody has an opportunity for me, I can think about the pros and the cons, the risks and the benefits. And even though I might be anxious, I might still then be able to say, okay, I'll accept that opportunity. But until we get to that point where we can even name what we're feeling, we're not there yet. And I think it's so important. And people will say stuff like, well, your feelings really don't have a place in the workplace, or you check your feelings at the door. We're human beings. We don't just check them at the door. They come to work with us. So recognizing them, naming them, even if it's just to yourself, you don't have to go to your boss and say, I'm feeling really disappointed today. But recognizing it to yourself can really help you then say, okay, and how might this emotion be affecting me? It's not bad. It's not that I necessarily need to change it, but just being aware of it can be important.
Absolutely. Last thing I want you to share, and then we'll tell everyone where they can keep following you. You talk about mental health compared to mental strength, and I'm hoping you can just close us out so that everyone thinks about their own mental health and mental strength and how it's accessible for all of us. These terms aren't just for when you're struggling.
Oh, I'm glad you said that, because sometimes people will say, well, I can't be mentally strong because I have depression. So I want people to know that mental health and mental strength are not the same thing. It's kind of like you could go to the gym and work out to become physically strong. If I start lifting some weights, my muscles get bigger. But that doesn't mean I won't ever get a physical health issue. I might still have high cholesterol or high blood pressure, despite the fact that I'm working on building physical strength. Well, mental strength's the same. It's really helpful. It can help you improve your mental health, but just because you have a mental health issue doesn't mean that you're weak. And that people aren't born mentally strong. It's all about the choices that we make every single day. And it's not about feeling strong 100% of the time either. It's just about knowing, what am I going to do when I don't feel strong? And I think we all have room for improvement. And there's something that we can do every single day to say, how do I grow stronger today? In fact, I encourage people to do that. At the end of the day, just ask yourself, what did I do today to grow mentally stronger? And it might be I spoke up in a meeting. Maybe it's I didn't say anything in a meeting because I tend to talk too much. But just knowing, look, what am I working on? How are my emotions? How has my thinking changed? How has my behavior changed? And what did I do today to grow just a little bit stronger? That no matter how difficult things are in the world or what you're going through, you always have an opportunity to build mental strength.
Absolutely. Okay, everyone needs to go get the Mental Strength Playbook. It's Amy's most recent book. But Amy, where can everyone keep up with your work, find some of your other books? Give us the most important places that people can go.
So my website is Amy Morin, LCSW is in licensedclinicalsocialworker.com. And on there, you'll find links to all 7 of my books and my TEDx talk, as well as my podcast, which is called Mentally Stronger with Therapist Amy Morin.
And I just listened to your TED talk yesterday. It was amazing. If anyone feels like they want the abridged version or something to get their feet wet, that is a great place to start. Amy does a great job breaking things down and explaining these frameworks that she teaches on a deeper level in her books. Amy, thank you so much for the time today. I really appreciate you not only talking about your work, but sharing your personal journey too, because I think sometimes we think people, therapists, whoever, authors have it all figured out. And to hear your journey is continuous, I think is inspiring for everyone. So thank you so much for the time today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.